Too many people cite the Jetsons as some sort of cultural touchstone for future technology.
Meet George Jetson.
But that's what everyone mentions when they mention flying cars. Where's my Jetson car? And that's obviously where everyone remembers that.
Hey, welcome to Politico Tech. Today's Thursday, July 11th. I'm Stephen Overly. You just heard Wired Senior Innovation Editor Jeremy White. I called him up after I got back from CES in January. As many of you know, CES is a behemoth tech conference, and it's always a trip. Sort of a visit from the future. And while I was there, I kept thinking about flying cars. And why it's this tech myth that won't die. Here's Jeremy again.
This merging of the car and some sort of aeroplane, sort of flying vehicle that you can also drive on the road, seems to be a very particular cultural demand for humans. Like, for some reason, it has persisted. This is where we think we are going to go.
The flying car occupies an almost mythological place in the arc of technological innovation. The Curtiss Autoplane was the first attempt at a flying car. That debuted at the Pan American Aeronautic Exposition in New York City in 1917. And this thing had the body of a car, with detachable wings and a tail sort of stuck on. It reportedly lifted, or maybe kind of hopped, off the ground, but it never actually took flight. Today, there are flying cars that actually fly, though they use the less cool name Electric Vertical Takeoff and Landing Aircraft, or eVTOLs. And let's be real, many of these things resemble helicopters or drones more than anything else. Not a trace of the Jetsons. And we're still not living in that flying car future. But that could change soon. For the next two episodes, I talked to four people who represent different sides of this story. Jeremy White at Wired, who you already heard. Cheryl Connolly, the former futurist for Ford Motor Company. Michael Whitaker, the current administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration, who actually worked at a flying car company before heading up the agency. And Jim Duchovny, the founder and CEO of Aleph Aeronautics, who is trying to bring flying cars to the mainstream for $300,000 a pop. Here's my conversation with Jeremy White, who's been tracking this technology closely to separate the hype from the here and now. How close are we to realizing this? Like, how far off is that future?
If you look at what we're building now as flying cars, supposedly flying cars, they're helicopters. They're not flying cars. They are air taxis, or whatever they want to call them now. So this idea of driving along the road and then being able to take off, I don't know hardly anybody that's really working on that or in any serious way or not. The ones that are being developed now are air taxis, are massive drones on steroids, basically.
Right. When you put it that way, that flying cars are just helicopters, it sounds a lot less sexy and, like, you know, less cool in some ways. I don't know. I guess this, like, fascination that we have with the flying car, I don't know if it comes from a place of convenience, like, oh, wouldn't it be really cool in the future if we could just get in a car and fly someplace or get someplace faster? But it's just this fascination that has persisted. For some reason, it just will not die.
Yeah, it won't go away. And I don't think it's going to go away. Even after we get flying taxis, these eVTOLs, these electric vertical takeoff and landing vehicles that are supposedly just around the corner, I still think we're going to get people saying, well, I know that's not the vision I wanted. You know, that's not what I had in my head. I had a car that I would get in and I would drive. And then I would, if I wanted to fly, I would fly. Peter Thiel famously said that I wanted flying cars, or we wanted flying cars, but instead we got 140 characters.
Have you ever seen one of these prototypes in person or demoed in person? I've actually only ever seen highly produced videos that obviously make it look super cool, but tech companies can do a lot of smoke and mirrors with video editing. So I'm curious if you've ever seen this IRL.
I've not been inside a working prototype, no, but I've sat in the Supernal SA2
What was that like?
At CES. Very fancy. Really, really plush, I have to say. And if fancy in the way that, you know, that concept cars are fancy, and then the reality comes along a few years later and says, hey, this isn't as fancy as the one you showed off, you know, a few years ago. But yeah, it was, you know, very lightweight. The seats were all sort of skeletal. And of course, they were 3D, you know, they were 3D designed and they were in AI design. So they had little weight as possible in them. So like holes where they could have holes still was just as strong. There's glass everywhere, blinking lights. I mean, it looked like the future and all that sort of business as well. So, you know, these things are very much in the stage of that sort of concept car, you know, like it's going to look right. like this. Whether they look like that when they're finally in the air remains to be seen, but they'll probably be similar.
Right. Yeah. It might not quite be like a cardboard box with some propellers on it, but who knows if it will be, who knows if it will have every bell and whistle that you can build into like a mock-up of it, you know, without actually having to prove it works. I'm curious what you see as the potential benefits are to flying cars. I mean, it's cool, right? But is cool really enough to make that concept a reality? How does it actually help us?
That's a really good question, because every time you speak to somebody about something about flying cars or air taxis or whatever you want to call them, is that they go, this is going to transform transport. This is going to change transport, you know, for everybody. It's going to make it for everybody. It's going to make it so we can all take these, but it's going to, they're going to come down in price so quickly that, you know, you won't take a taxi to the airport anymore. You'll call one of our air taxis and you'll jump in it and it'll be comparable in price to getting an Uber. You know, like I find that incredibly hard to believe, you know, almost impossible to believe. So what you've got here is it does really feel like a development of a technology for rich people and for the privileged and the well-off. Because, it's, you know, they're all about sort of, you know, journeys of up to 100 miles, but mainly sort of 20, 30, 40 miles, really, for the range and the battery technology we've got at the moment. Now, that doesn't sound to me like something for the masses. That sounds to me like something for people who fly business class or upper class, if we're going to be honest about it.
Exactly.
And so, like, but everyone you talk to in the business, in this sort of flying car business, they always say, no, 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 this is going to be for everybody. It's going to be so cheap. It's going to be for everybody. I just can't see that. Where are these vehicles going to fit into the existing infrastructure? Because if they're using the existing heliports to do those sorts of journeys, well, they've got to share that infrastructure and that airspace with the helicopters that are already using it as well. You've got to also work out, you know, what sort of charging times they're going to be able to have for that too. And it's a situation where you go, well, if we're just taking one form of transport, i.e. helicopters, and we're switching it into electric helicopters for exactly the same target of people, I don't understand how this is going to be revolutionizing transport for all.
Right. I mean, there's also something about getting in your flying car, your flying taxi, just to go to the airport to get on a plane, that seems like, you know, just why isn't this thing just taking me where I want to go? You know, like, we're already in the air, like, let's get a move on. I want to elaborate a little bit on the last comment you made there, because when I hear flying cars being in Washington, my head immediately goes to regulation, you know, in the sense that even with self-driving cars on the road, we have not sorted out a million regulatory questions, traffic law questions, liability questions, et cetera. So the idea of putting cars in the air just seems like a complete Pandora's box of regulatory and legal issues. Is that as big or even bigger of an obstacle here than the technology itself?
The main thing that's holding them back is, as you say, is the regulation and whether, you know, what they're actually going to do about it. So the FAA, notoriously slow on drone technology, on drone regulation. And when they did eventually bring out regulation, it was woefully inadequate as well. And it was years behind being the time. It was like, my God, you know, like, it's like shutting the door after a horse has bolted. Whereas in China, they moved far faster and they became sort of the leader, really, in drone regulation. Now, the US is, you know, is a leader in aviation regulations. I mean, you know, the FAA, I think, has about 45,000 people. And it's like the largest body in the world that has this sort of thing. So there is pressure from the politicians And I think quite rightly, for the US to not lose this position in being a leader in aviation regulation worldwide, and particular, obviously, with flying cars and flying air taxis. And so you've got this will, this political will to push these things through and make regulation and make it so this is a viable business sector in the US, and obviously reaching out from there. And there's proof of that too. You know, there's a sort of cross-pollination or cannibalization of the flying drone industry and the FAA. Billy Nolen was the FAA administrator, now is at Archer. Now Mike Whitaker is the new administrator, and he comes from Supernal, which obviously is Hyundai's arm of that. So they're in this world and they're trying to make it work. But Supernal is a good example, because they were saying back in January that their SA2 flying taxi is going to adhere to existing current FAA regulations. And so they're saying, we're not asking for a special treatment. We're going to make this as standard for everything else that that flies at the moment. So, you know, some people are saying, okay, right, we need the regulations for these sorts of things to be changed to make it easier for us to enter market, or make it more viable, or, you know, recognize that these are different vehicles. And some, like Supernal, are saying, well, no, we're just going to match your regulations you got now.
So, yeah, I mean, it will be interesting how this evolves. I am skeptical of the idea of being just able to comply with existing regulation and everyone being okay with that.
I've been looking at this sector for a good number of years now from Wired's point of view. And, they're always just over the horizon. They're always just 1 or 2 years away, or 3 or 4 years away. And so I'll be amazed if we do start to see them, you know, next year. You know, that seems to me to be very optimistic. But, you know, I want to be wrong. Like everyone else dreaming about these flying cars, you know, I want to see them. But I'm, and I work at Wired, and I'm an early adopter. But I don't want to be the first person flying in these things. Thank you very much. I want to see how they go for a while before I get in them.
Exactly. Someone else go first, and then I'll take the second trip.
Exactly. But I cannot get away. Going back to where we started, I cannot quieten that boy in me going, like Peter Thiel, I want my flying cars. Where are my flying cars? Now, what on earth would I use it for? I don't know. But we still want them nonetheless.
So Jeremy wants his flying car, and he wants it now. Cheryl Connolly, on the other hand, doesn't really do now. She spent nearly 30 years at Ford Motor Company, thinking about the future. But as I learned, a futurist isn't necessarily what you would expect.
It's really easier to explain what a futurist does not do, at least in my practice.
Here's our conversation.
And I don't predict the future, which is a little bit ironic. I know the title is terribly misleading. But the truth of the matter is that everyone tries to predict the future each and every day. But in a corporate setting, in a company like Ford Motor Company, where you have this extraordinarily long lead time and capital investment for products, you need to make sure that you're thinking about the future in a really meaningful and purposeful way. And that's by reminding people that the assumptions that we have that built into our everyday don't necessarily mean that they'll play out. So my job is to be kind of the polite contrarian and say, what if it doesn't happen that way?
I love the idea of being the polite contrarian. I'm curious to hear you elaborate a little bit on that, because at the risk of sounding trite, I was sort of curious if futuring is more sort of, you know, sitting around the table, you know, dreaming big versus like really specifically and strategically trying to figure out what's coming around the corner.
So I actually think it probably exists on a spectrum of those two bookends that you talked about. I like to say to people that most people are futuristic. Like if you're in strategy, product development, finance, treasury, all of those organizations are always thinking about the longer term. They're trying to prepare. But the tools that they use are really different. And I think what companies tend to perhaps over-rely on are quantitative modeling. And if we really had the ability to predict the future with those models, then you wouldn't, you know, there would be no mystery left in life. I think human nature is such as that it's really easy for us to imagine all the ways things can go wrong.
Sure.
My team and I used to spend all our time trying to push back about what are the many ways things can go right. I mean, we also still have to kind of point out that, you know, your sales numbers might be overtly optimistic. Like, for instance, one of the things that we really tried to challenge people with over a decade ago was that the car might not always be seen as this ultimate status symbol. I mean, if you were a baby boomer growing up, getting your first car was this gateway moment into adulthood. And people use it as a measure of how hard they work. This is the best measure of my success. In fact, we used to say for baby boomers, the car was the most expensive suit they would ever own. Mm. But could you imagine a 30-year-old feeling that way? Those markers just don't resonate. The access you have, the influence you have, those are probably more significant measures of status than any material possession.
In all of your years of sort of strategizing and looking at the data and trying to think about the future, did the idea of the flying car ever actually show up in sort of your proverbial vision board or spreadsheet?
It did come up in kind of a fun little query. In 2022, I think it was, we're celebrating the 10-year anniversary of our annual trend report. And this was a survey that we did globally. And we would ask people different attitudes about their thoughts. And we were trying to get people to think about the distant future. And one of the questions we asked is, when do you think the flying car will become a reality? And worldwide, and this is about 15 countries, 38% of men said it would happen by the year 2050. Women were much more skeptical at 27%. But if you'd look at it by country, 61% of men and women in the UAE thought it would happen by 2050, followed closely behind by Saudi Arabia. And then India and China were 49 and 44%, respectively. And so I think that's interesting, because when you compare it to some Western points of view, the U.S. was only at a modest 24%, and the country that was most skeptical was the U.K. at a mere 17%. It's just kind of fun to see where people's heads are. And I do think that men across the board all were a little bit more inclined to believe that would happen than women.
That's fascinating. You know, I wonder, all your time in the automotive industry, do folks in that sector ever talk about the idea of a flying car, even in just sort of a fun way? It's just, you know, it's such kind of a cultural phenomenon, has been for so long. I wonder if people who are actual serious car folks ever talk about it.
So in the role of my job, no. In fact, when we were just, like I said, we were pushing the boundaries to kind of see people's appetite for the distant future. We asked questions about robotics and artificial intelligence and things like that. And so when I started talking about these numbers about flying cars, there were a few eye rolls in the room. But I do think it's an evergreen topic. I mean, I grew up watching the Jetsons on television. I thought I would have seen a flying car, or at least in my youth, I was promised that there would be one by now. So I think that it has held on to the imagination of people worldwide. And I don't know that that's ever going to go away.
I wonder if you were to, like, you know, just with me now, kind of think through this idea of a flying car from a futurist mindset. I mean, what would you think of as sort of the hurdles and barriers, or the potentials? I guess, how would you even go about sort of assessing whether this thing could ever be real?
That is a conversation we've had in terms of a futuring exercise. And you can look to the electric takeoff and landing vehicles, the eTOLs. These are kind of almost, in a layman's term, to my basic understanding, think of it almost as a replacement to helicopters. But right now, there's a lot of development in that space, and they expect that there'll be about $30 billion value by the year 2030 in that space. But they're very clear obstacles in terms of trying to bring it to the marketplace. One, they're trying to use battery technology. So you've got the weight of the battery, but you also have the range of the battery. And right now, for that sort of application is quite low. You need infrastructure. I mean, we're having trouble getting the infrastructure we need for electric vehicles, the cars that are on the road today. Range anxiety is a huge obstacle for a lot of buyers. If you live in your own home and you can have a charging station, that's fine. But if you want this electric takeoff and landing vehicle, where the infrastructure is going to be increasingly important. But then you've got regulations, and the regulations are going to be the most complex part of it. And you can see, I think, a leading indicator of what kind of challenges you would have in this space are akin to what you're seeing with drones right now, is that right. What's the safety of drones? Forget about the whole, like, criminal national security issue. Let's just talk about the application. I mean, there were stories about people being injured with, you know, a drone dropping from the sky, operated by a young boy or a girl, and it's just for fun, recreation. And so there was this notion about, like, well, what are the safeguards? You know, how do you register this? How do you know who's the owner of it? How do you think about the legalities of it? Who's responsible for that crash if it were to happen? And those are very similar questions that we had around self-driving vehicles.
You mentioned the Jetsons a little bit ago. I wonder if you remember your own sort of first cultural exposure to the flying car.
So the two things that informed me were the Jetsons and Lost in Space. No, so I am a Gen Xer. So these things were on reruns, but they were like Saturday afternoon fodder. And I remember those two things being my notion about what travel would look like in the future. And I don't know if you're old enough to remember Lost in Space, but it was kind of like this Family Robinson thing set, you know, out in the galaxy. Right. But they had this, they had their spaceship, and they also had this all-terrain vehicle when they got to a new planet where they could go explore. And they would invariably run into different troubles, usually some sort of intergalactic monster of some sort. But if they can make their way back to their vehicle, they're always safe. Like, it was safe from meteors. It was safe from, you know, any sort of external threat. And I always thought that was really important, that notion about the car becoming this safety capsule. And I think when it comes to vehicles that are on the ground or in the air, that's, I think, paramount to the occupants, is how safe do I feel in this? I think that's what drives most people.
You know, you did this survey. You asked folks if they thought flying cars would be around by the year 2050. Completely unshackled yourself from sort of the critical thinking of being a futurist. What do you think? You know, will we have flying cars by 2050, or what does the future of the flying car potentially look like?
Wow. That's interesting, because I just caught my own bias. A part of me wanted to say, my gut was first, yeah, no, it'll happen after 2050. You know, I do think it'll happen. I do believe that there's a future will happen. I think there's, like I said, this evergreen interest in that becoming a reality. But then my own experience, my own professional experience, is that people tend to overestimate how long things will take. Like, we give too much importance to the near term and not enough importance to the longer term. And we're always surprised when things happen faster than they expect. So for me, it's like a 50-50, you know, over under, like, will it happen by the year 2050 or not? I could argue both ways. But I guess if I were putting good money on it, I'd say after 2050.
Cheryl, I could talk about the future all day. This has been so fascinating. And I really thank you for taking the time to join us on Politico Tech.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So the flying car has long been part of our fascination with the future, but it's also closer to becoming a reality. We'll dig into that on tomorrow's show. I talked to Jim Duchovny, the CEO of California-based Aleph Aeronautics, which already has over 3,000 people waiting to buy a car that they say can transition from the road to the sky. But none of that can happen until Washington signs off. And that's where FAA Administrator Mike Whitaker comes into the conversation. His job is to set the rules for flying cars and prevent an airborne pileup.
You're going to start seeing aircraft certified, I think, next year that would be referred to by some as flying cars. So I think we're really at the beginning of that that era where we're going to start seeing them in the marketplace.
That's all for today's Politico Tech. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Today's episode was produced by Annie Reese and Afra Abdullah. I'm Stephen Overley. See you back here tomorrow.